It's 5:05. What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has pledged nearly $1 billion in new U.S. aid for Syrian refugees at an international donors conference and is calling for the Syrian government and Russia to halt attacks on rebel-held areas in order to let humanitarian aid through. The conference opened Thursday in London. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron.
Today's conference has seen the largest amount of money ever raised in one day in response to a humanitarian crisis, with well over $10 billion pledged.
The amount pledged aims to support people in Syria as well as in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, neighboring countries that are strained by the exodus of refugees fleeing the fighting. Somali officials investigating an apparent bomb blast that forced a passenger jet to make an emergency landing in Mogadishu say the explosion was likely the work of the militant group Al-Shabaab. Speaking to VOA, Somalia's former National Intelligence Director, Ahmed Mualim Fiki, says the nature of the incident and the evidence available so far both indicate it was a planned bomb attack. The senior U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, Army General John Campbell, told lawmakers here in Washington on Thursday that training for Afghan forces will be severely constrained if the number of American troops there is cut to 5,500, as President Obama is proposing. Congressional critics of Mr. Obama's military operations against the Taliban fighters in Afghanistan say reduced U.S. troop levels will undermine the American efforts that started shortly after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. This is VOA News. A Pakistani Islamist leader accused of masterminding the 2008 Mumbai attacks that killed more than 160 people has threatened India will face a wave of violence unless it stops military oppression of the people in the disputed Kashmir region. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim has details.
The founder of Lashkar-e-Taiba, Hafiz Saeed, who India blamed for the Mumbai carnage, issued the warning while addressing a gathering in Muzaffarabad, the capital of the Pakistani-administered portion of Kashmir. He again told New Delhi to withdraw its 700,000-member army from the Himalayan region or face consequences. He says if India continues what he calls a policy of trying to crush Kashmir's independence and struggle with military might, then violence will go further. Ayesha Tanzim, Islamabad.
World Health Organization advising officials not to accept blood donations from people who recently returned from countries affected by the Zika virus. Mosquito-borne virus is most prevalent in Latin America, particularly Brazil, and poses its greatest danger to pregnant women. WHO also is voicing concern over a case of Zika virus in the U.S. state of Texas caused by sexual transmission. Christian Landmeer is with the WHO.
The ways of transmission have to be strongly looked into. Any possible sources of infection for the Zika virus have to be studied carefully. There are many ways which could be a transmission could happen, although right now the vast majority of cases are done by mosquito bites, of course. We do know that the virus stays in the blood for a certain while. We don't even know the exact time.
Virus was discovered in Uganda's Zika forest in 1947, but scientists say it never has been a major problem on the continent. There's speculation that Zika in the Americas may be a different strain, but further study is needed to confirm that. President Obama has promised to provide more financial aid and other support for Colombia as the government prepares to finalize a peace deal with the left-wing guerrillas that has battled for more than 50 years. After meeting with Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos at the White House Thursday, Mr. Obama announced additional funding and other measures he said that will help Colombia rebuild after its fight in its agreement with FARC. U.S. politics, two remaining Democratic presidential candidates, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, held a debate, a tense one, they said, at times, in the state of New Hampshire, comes just days before the state holds the nation's first presidential primary.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Another presidential election debate has been scheduled in Uganda, but will President Museveni participate this time around?
Seven candidates have confirmed their participation, and plans are underway to reach to the eighth candidate. And hopefully, by end of tomorrow or Monday, we should have reached the eighth candidate.
Joshua Kitakule is Secretary General of the Interreligious Council of Uganda. South Sudan government accuses rebel forces of besieging Bentiu, the capital of Lake State. And Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara says he will not send any more Ivorians to the ICC, but the opposition is skeptical.
My understanding is that Mr. Ouattara doesn't want reconciliation, and he is simply trying to protect his own people from being prosecuted at the ICC.
Boubacar Kone is interim spokesperson of the Ivorian Popular Front Party of former President Laurent Gbagbo. Some civil society organizations in Zimbabwe are skeptical of government's promise to pay outstanding bonuses beginning this month. And a Nigerian artist teaches West African music and dance to South Africans. Those stories, plus Mark Oman's post, and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Interreligious Council of Uganda says the last presidential debate ahead of the February 18th general election will proceed as planned on February 13th, despite local media reports that incumbent President Yoweri Museveni will not participate again. Organizers say they are in negotiations with the ruling National Resistance Movement for Mr. Museveni's participation. The focus of the debate will be on foreign policy, regional integration, peace and security, and international trade and investment. Joshua Kitakule, Secretary General of the Interreligious Council, says positive feedback about the first debate led to the decision to organize the second and final one.
I can confirm to you that the organizers have confirmed the second phase of the debate and it will take place on the Saturday, 2016.
What about the participation of the presidential candidates who will be vying to challenge incumbent President Yoweri Museveni?
Seven candidates have confirmed their participation and plans are underway to reach to the eighth candidate, and hopefully by end of tomorrow or Monday, we should have reached the eighth candidate, and we are praying that the eighth candidate also confirms his participation in the debate.
Some Ugandans have expressed concern after speculation that the NRM will not make available President Museveni to participate in the presidential debate. What is your response to such local media reports on that?
Ours is a platform given to the presidential candidates to take advantage of. It is a nonpartisan, it is impartial, it's an independent space. So it is not a space that we are forcing any candidate to come. But any candidate that finds value, that finds benefit from it, will definitely come to that debate. And I know that President Seven would love to come, and we are trying to negotiate with him so that he's able to find benefit and take advantage of this space.
What response are you getting so far from the public following the first debate and the demand for a second and final one? Because some people say that his lack or his refusal to participate in the first debate instead to meet the women folk of his party undermined the essence of trying to give Ugandans the choice to listen to all the candidates and to make an informed decision. What is your response to that?
Ugandans are excited, and I can tell you conversations are everywhere in the marketplace, in the bus park, in the saloons, everywhere they are looking for the second debate. You can check that on Twitter, you can check that on Facebook, you can check that in the media. Every Ugandan is excited about the second debate. Why? Because they find value when their leaders, when leaders that are offering themselves, are able to come together, share the same platform to talk about what they want to do for this country at the same time. So it's exciting to Ugandans. It's the first thing that has ever happened to Uganda.
Joshua Kitakule is the Secretary General of the Interreligious Council of Uganda. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. In Ivory Coast, an official of the party of former President Laurent Gbagbo is accusing President Alassane Ouattara of trying to protect his supporters from being prosecuted by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. This follows Mr. Ouattara's announcement yesterday, Thursday, that he will not send any more Ivorians to the ICC. Mr. Ouattara's predecessor, Laurent Gbagbo, and his former youth minister, Charles Blaye Goudé, are currently on trial at the ICC for their alleged roles in the 2010 post-election violence. Mr. Ouattara said Ivory Coast now has an operational justice system. But Boubacar Kone, interim spokesman of the Ivorian Popular Front Party, says President Ouattara is trying to neutralize mounting international demands for some of his supporters to also be prosecuted by the ICC.
My understanding is that Mr. Ouattara doesn't want reconciliation, and he is simply trying to protect his own people from being prosecuted by the ICC, because people around the world have been critical about the ICC being unfair, because they are investigating only one side, the conflict. Now, Mr. Ouattara is trying to dodge by saying that nobody else is being sent to the ICC, while justice in Cote d'Ivoire is not at all fair. You wonder.
The president said he does not want to send people because he believes the judicial system, the justice system in the Ivory Coast is now working.
The fact that the judicial system is working does not mean that it is working fairly. The judicial system in our country is very unfair, and we don't see the signs of true reconciliation there. He's just trying to hide his people from being judged fairly. To tell the truth, he should say that his people are in power, and he's trying to protect them.
Mr. Kone, one would think that the offer by the president not to send any more Ivorian is in the interest of reconciliation in Ivory Coast.
It is not. It is definitely not, because the vast majority of Ivorians think that this is definitely unfair. Unfair because we know that the judicial system at home is not fair. And it is unfair because the vast majority of criminals linked to the electoral crisis belong to Mr. Ouattara's side. So this is the way a way to hide them from being judged and prosecuted.
Even Amnesty International people have said that exactly what you said, that it's time for the international community to look into investigating supporters of the president who also might have committed crimes. The president denies that he's trying to only punish supporters of President Gbagbo.
He can deny that, but the facts are there. How many of these people have been prosecuted? We are in the fifth year of his rule. It is definitely clear for the people of Cote d'Ivoire and the international community that he is not determined to play the game of reconciliation. Otherwise, I don't think 5 years is not enough time to start.
What exactly do you want? I mean, how can reconciliation come about in the Ivory Coast?
To have reconciliation, he first needs to free all the innocent people that he imprisoned for 5 years now. Because the fact that those people are in jail for nothing, and the fact that thousands of our fellow citizens are abroad in exile, are no good factors for reconciliation at all.
Boubacar Kone is interim spokesman of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party of former President Laurent Gbagbo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abidjan. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, February 5th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government is claiming that armed opposition forces have besieged Bentiu, the capital of newly created Northern Lake State. Government spokesman Michael McQuay says all roads around Bentiu are closed. But as Philipton Alert reports for VOA from Juba, the SPLM in opposition denies any unusual movement of its troops in the area.
Minister Michael McQuay told reporters after an extraordinary Council of Ministers meeting yesterday that SPLM in opposition forces are on the move toward Bentiu.
He's observed that there is a regrouping of rebel forces around Bentiu town. They have besieged the town, they have blocked all the routes that lead into the town, and their intentions are not known.
McQuay says the opposition did not notify the government about their motives for relocating forces around Bentiu town.
If it is the establishment of cantonment areas, then cantonment areas are usually established in collaboration and in agreement with the parties concerned. You don't just go and choose a place and say, I will have my cantonment place here.
McQuay says the government is monitoring the movement of the opposition troops. James Gadet, a spokesman for SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar, denies their forces are regrouping around Bentiu.
This is not true. They are in their base there, around Bentiu, and they have been there for a very long time. Although the government and SPLM-IO are still discussing the locations of cantonment. They have not yet agreed on specific locations for cantonment area, but the bases are there. And we also propose some of the bases to be our cantonment area, but these are yet to be agreed upon by the two parties.
Gadet says the opposition troops are under instruction to respect the permanent ceasefire. He says the government should not use the alleged closure of roads leading to Bentiu as a pretext to attack rebel bases. The ceasefire and transitional security arrangement monitoring mechanism, which is supposed to monitor violations of the permanent ceasefire, declined to comment on the alleged military activity in Bentiu, but released a statement saying it is investigating several clashes in Yambio and other parts of former Western Equatorial State. UNMISS spokesperson did not confirm or deny presence of rebel troops around Bentiu town. There have been no attacks on the main towns in the greater Upper Nile region since the peace agreement was signed 5 months ago. Fighting had been fierce in the region at the height of the conflict. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
Some civil society organizations in Zimbabwe have expressed skepticism over reports that the government will pay outstanding 2015 bonuses from this month up to May this year. In a statement, the Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe says it views the move as a major victory against the government, which it had given up to the middle of this month to pay the bonuses or face industrial action. But Cecilia Alexander, president of the Public Service Association, says they are not sure whether to celebrate because the government has not officially presented any bonus payment plans to state workers.
We just also learned about it when we read the papers today, but we are quite disturbed as an organization that the government continues not to respect the fora that we are supposed to meet and discuss issues. And this is a clear indication that they don't respect organized labor. So we are saying everything that concerns us should be first of all presented to us before it is presented to the nation. And we are saying it is very difficult for us to just believe after reading these media reports. Because sometimes the media can go to town about issues. And we are saying we need to be informed formally. There is a forum where we are supposed to meet the workers' representatives and government. And that is the NGNC. And we expect that the information should come through the NGNC.
Are you going to approach the government over this issue?
Yes, we are going to make a follow-up because our members also need the correct information. They need official information. So I'm told there's a meeting that has been canceled for next week. But Mr. Jongaiti is still not desirable that the information is already in the papers and the whole nation has been informed about it before us also sitting down to discuss this issue.
What about the other issues that you have been raising all along? Pertaining to your conditions of service, are you going to present this to the government?
Yes, there are a lot of issues that you have been presenting. Some of them we've presented them for more than 2 years now, and most of the issues or promises have remained pies in the sky.
That was Public Service Association President Cecilia Alexander speaking with Jonga Kandibiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. An acclaimed Nigerian actress and dancer is inspiring growing numbers of South Africans to get up and boogie. Vera Ephraim is also an award-winning choreographer, having collaborated with a host of celebrated African musicians, including South Africa's Hugh Masekela and Nigeria's Femi Kuti. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
A lithe woman in a turquoise vest and wide patterned pants shouts instructions inside a studio in Johannesburg. Her thick black curls glisten with sweat as she explains how she began her unique mission here about a year ago.
I had a lot of encouragement from a group of friends who said, Vera, you know, can you start a dance class? I really want to know what Western African dance looks like, what it sounds like, what it feels like, how is it different from Southern African movement?
Vera Ephraim has university diplomas in performance art from Britain, has danced in productions across Europe, and acted in some of South Africa's top TV shows. Now, though, she's busy with what she describes as her greatest challenge yet, teaching complete novices the art of traditional West African dancing. Ephraim says West African dancers are very fast and driven by the djembe drum.
In West Africa, we use a lot of djembe drumming. The rhythm is different also, of course, because djembe produces up to 4 or 5 rhythms on its own.
One of her eager pupils is Renske van den Hoff, a social policy analyst from the Netherlands. She says the djembe frees her and makes her feel part of the continent.
The drums obviously help to feel more an African feeling, get a more African vibe to it, yeah.
Ephraim says West African dancers use a lot of hip movement and dance with their whole bodies. In what Ephraim calls a harvesting dance, her students hurl their bodies forward while their arms scrape the floor.
If you're harvesting, your arms are plucking the apples or your arms are digging out the yam from the soil.
She also fuses more modern African music with djembe drums to spice things up for her students, she says. Ephraim explains that the dances she teaches have storylines.
This dance is from Ghana, it's for marriage. And this movement here signifies that the girl has been shy, the girl has been shy, the shaking the shoulder. And then this is the guy posing like, I see you, I'm coming over.
Her dancers are a diverse bunch, from domestic workers to rich businessmen to Emi Kawamura, an administrator for a Japanese car company.
Even if we are just a beginner, even if we don't know the technique, we can always enjoy.
Ephraim's present classes have been filled up by a group of expatriate professionals. Procurement manager Laura Del Castillo from Spain says West African dancing is fun and challenging.
It's a great experience just listening to music, not thinking about anything else but concentrating on what step you have to do next and just laughing about yourself and how wrong you're doing it. So.
Alejandro Campiero, an economist from Mexico, says she's learning West African dance purely because of Ephraim's dynamism.
She's always full of good energy and has this power that not everybody can. She gets everybody into the mood, and that's so nice.
Ephraim says nothing gives her more satisfaction than watching her students grow and connect with West African movements and stories here in the heart of South Africa. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Awoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Yves Bissouma scored with 2 minutes to the final whistle to lift Mali to a 1-0 triumph against Ivory Coast at the Orange African Nations Championship semi-finals at the Nyamirambo Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda on Thursday. Early on Wednesday, the Democratic Republic of Congo pipped Guinea 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout. On Sunday, Guinea and Ivory Coast clash in the bronze medal playoff before the Democratic Republic of Congo engage Mali in the finals. Both matches will be played at the Amahoro National Stadium in Kigali. Meanwhile, Mozambique is the most improved African team, while Libya has slipped by the widest margin in the world, according to the FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Ranked 28th, African champions Ivory Coast are the highest placed African team. Cape Verde Islands at 33rd, Algeria 36th, Ghana 41st, Senegal 45th, Tunisia 48th, the Republic of Congo 54th, Egypt 55th, the Democratic Republic of Congo 57th, and Guinea 61st. In cricket, South Africa dismissed Ireland by 8 wickets in the quarterfinals at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh on Thursday. Today, Zimbabwe engage Canada in Cox's Bazar, while Namibia play India in Fatula tomorrow, Saturday. In rugby, South Africa play Scotland as Kenya face Russia at the start of their Group B preliminaries at the IRB Sevens series in Sydney, Australia tomorrow, Saturday. South Africa lead the series standing at the start of the fourth leg of the nine-leg series with 54 points. Kenya is 8th with 30, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. In athletics, over 20,000 athletes are set to line up for the Lagos International Marathon in Nigeria's commercial capital tomorrow, Saturday. This race was last contested in 1983. Finally, in boxing, Ghana's former WBO Intercontinental Super Featherweight Champion Joseph Laria steps into the ring to fight Tanzanian Issa Nampepeche. The 8-round non-title bout takes place in Bradford, some 200 kilometers north of London in the United Kingdom tomorrow, Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We see you again on Monday morning.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 5th. On this day, 1934, Henry Louis Hank Aaron was born in Mobile, Alabama. He became baseball's all-time home run hitter. Aaron entered the record books on April 8, 1974, when he broke Babe Ruth's record of 714 home run hits. He went on to hit a total of 755 home runs before completing his 23-year major league career. On this day in 1972, Robert Bob Douglas became the first African-American to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Douglas was the founder of the New York Renaissance basketball team. Nicknamed the father of black professional basketball, Douglas owned and coached the Rens from 1923 to 1949. On this day in 1990, Barack Obama, the son of an African man from Kenya, now president of the United States, became the first African American to be named president of the Harvard Law Review in the 104-year history of the review. And in African history, on this day in 1956, 9 Mau Mau prisoners who were serving life sentences escaped from Mageta Island in Lake Victoria. The Mau Mau uprising was an insurgency by Kenyan rebels against the British colonial administration from 1952 to 1960. Also in African history on this day in 1977, the Front for the Liberation of Mozambique, FRELIMO, announced its plans to turn Mozambique into a Marxist state. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 5th. Congratulations to Granton Weta Undungua of Juba, South Sudan, Malik Sise of Accra, Ghana, and Ras France Marco Ungogo of Tarime, Tanzania. You are the winners of our February 4th question, who was the first black student to attend the University of Alabama? The answer, Authorin J. Lucy. Now here is our question for today, February 5th. Whose arrest sparked the Montgomery bus boycott? Once again, whose arrest sparked the Montgomery bus boycott? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
So now we see the light. What you gonna we gonna stand up for a right. Yeah, so yeah, you better get up. Stand up in the morning. Give it up. Stand up for your right.
Stand up right now.
Get up. Stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. The United Nations is reporting new cases of alleged sexual abuse and exploitation by UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. That's it for this Friday, February 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll focus on the rising concerns over the global spread of the Zika virus. Join me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host and health experts as we discuss the Zika virus. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.